for that. Andy Milburn joins me this morning, and it's been a while, so I called. I texted Andy late last night for me, early this morning for him, and said, "Hey, man, why don't you come on and shoot the shit with me?" And so here he is today. But Andy's family's dealing with the death of his one of his older sisters, who took her own life. So first of all, Andy, from everybody who hears you and has got to know you a little bit on All Marine Radio, certainly our thoughts and prayers are with you and your family and your extended family. So sorry to hear that.
Thanks, Mac, and to everyone. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good to be back talking to you guys.
Tell us about your sister. I mean, these things are devastating. Tell us about her, though, the woman.
Yeah. So my sister. There's an age gap between us. She is 10 years older than me. I we used to joke in the family that. With a joke, but I think it's absolutely true that I was not planned. certainly a mistake. But yeah, my sister's 10 years older, and when we all know this, when someone passes away, there is quite rightly a tendency to eulogize them. So I'll tell you absolutely, and yes, I'm biased because she was my sister, but my sister was. An extraordinary person. I think the one thing, a couple of things have come out of this from her friends and family and myself included, and memory of her was, first of all, no one, she's one of those people that no one could be around her and not feel uplifted. Now that's such a paradox, isn't it? That someone like that should end up taking their life. Someone who really was just, it's difficult to describe, very effusive, but genuinely interested in other people. So sometimes you meet someone, and I think probably all of your listeners can think of at least one person in their life who they just love being around. And it's not because that person is necessarily the life of the party in a very superficial sense. It's because they have that kind of aura where they're genuinely interested in other people. They bring other people out of themselves and show genuine delight in hearing about them, and that is the way that Susan was. That was number one. And then number two, the other thing that, again, this isn't just me as her brother, but overwhelmingly everyone remembers her as being extraordinarily compassionate. And I'll give you just a couple of examples if your listeners will bear with me. You know, as long ago as, you know, taking us back, you know, this kind of the bookends of my time with her or my memory of her, you know, I was 11 years old when Vietnam fell in 1975, and we were in Hong Kong at the time. Actually, I just left Hong Kong, but my sister was still there, and there was, of course, the exodus of what became known as the boat people, the refugees who jumped in ramshackle craft to try and make it across the South China Sea, and Hong Kong was one of their first destinations where a number of them literally were washed up. And so they, you know, Hong Kong having overcrowding problems at the time, they all went into refugee camps. My sister, then in her very early 20s, volunteered to work in these refugee camps and used to work long hours, you know, just taking care of these people, as you imagine, must have been a pretty traumatic experience for someone who, you know, she had to that point led a pretty sheltered life, but she loved it. She loved it. You know, I remember the letters she wrote about that. Fast forward some 42, I'm doing the math wrong, and there's 40.
We can hear you struggling.
Yeah, so anyway, when I commanded the siege of Sodif in Iraq, and I turned over the siege of Sodif to the guy who replaced me, the SEAL commander, and had a few days, you know, as you do before you retrograde back to the United States. And my sister had sent me, you know, I wasn't particularly thrilled about this, but she had sent me package after package of kids' toys. And I had no idea what to do with them. I mean, my office was full of these toys. And, she had written me a letter saying, hey, listen, I want you to find kids who will really appreciate these toys. And, you know, it was one of those things that there was one part of me that just wanted to kind of put them in the dumpster. But of course, I couldn't do that. So I was up in Erbil in northern Iraq, and I heard about an orphanage for kids whose parents had been killed by the Islamic State, mostly Yazidi kids, you know, of course, right, who were victims essentially of a mini genocide. And so this is pretty unusual, but I managed to get permission to come and visit the orphanage. You can imagine there was a little bit of suspicion that a Marine, you know, a U.S. colonel wanted to come and visit this orphanage. But I did, and I took these piles of toys. And I wasn't sure how I would be received, but the kids went absolutely berserk. They loved it. And I needed Peshmerga guards there to help us apportion all these toys to the kids in the orphanage. And I took photos of them, sent them back to my sister, and she was overjoyed. You know, that made her so happy. It's difficult to describe. And so whatever else, what little I may have, you know, accomplished in my life, to her, that was a high point that I'd gone to the trouble to do that. And it was just, I mean, an extension of her compassion. She wasn't the sort of person to tell people she had done that, but that was her. So, you know, I think, Mac, I mean, hopefully you do by now, but it's always a difficult decision to talk about personal tragedies. We went through this. I remember when I talked about the loss of my daughter, and there's an element of you, of me, of all of us, especially who are Marines, who are naturally, we want to sit on our own problems and on things that have gone wrong in our life. But I tell you, when I talked about Kayla and the loss of Kayla and then coming back and the lessons and how in the end I learned some resilience from that awful experience, and I talked about it on your show, a number of people contacted me saying that it had helped them, you know, which if you can pull any meaning out of the shitty things that happen in life to you or me or anyone, then, you know, obviously you want to pull something out of it. So I guess, you know, that's why I'm telling you this story. It's certainly not to incur sympathy or anything. I think all of us shy away from that, but here's some points, and I hope they don't sound too cliched, but number one is, and this isn't the first suicide, obviously, that I've, you know, the first person I've been close to who's killed themselves, but it is the closest person. And you know, it's the first time that a near family member has killed themselves. And the first thing that hits me, of course, is the fact that no one expects it. But the second part is just the sense of, to add the devastation of loss, the sense of guilt, just guilt. And that it leaves in everyone's wake, the sense of if only I had known, if only I had done this, if only, you know, all of us, everyone. And you know, that's sadly an aspect of in the aftermath of suicide. From the notes that Susan left us, that, and I know she was totally unselfish and compassionate, so there's this strange dictonomy, and you're trying to say that word correctly, between someone who can be as unselfish as they are and yet do something that causes so much pain to those they love. So I think that's not a new message. We all know it's the case, but you know, for those who are ever contemplating doing something to themselves, I think that should be something that ultimately holds them up, is the knowledge of what it, of, you, no one will ever be the same. No one ever, you know, they may end their lives relatively abruptly, but no one they know and love will ever be the same again. And that should give, you know, certainly cause for thought.
You know, Andy, one of the interesting things about, you know, what this All Marine Raider was turned into in terms of post-traumatic winning is, and it's not something that I certainly ever scripted. I mean, I just essentially I followed the lead. The people that have come on this show have pointed me to, you know, I listen to them and in what you said are I think the most important things I've learned is one that's become the first commandment of post-traumatic winning, and that is don't fake it. And then the sixth commandment is you've got to talk about your shit. And if you don't, you put yourself on a path. Right, you put yourself on a path that most of the time doesn't lead to, you know, a good place, and for a lot of people, it just leads to a degradation of their life. Your inability to pronounce multisyllabic words is affecting me. It's for most people, it manifests itself in a degradation of their life.
Drinking, man.
I know.
Not unusual.
You know, I wish I had that as an excuse.
It's time in the morning.
Yeah, it's merely incompetence. The you know, and then taken to its extreme, right? It takes somebody to a place where that which would normally stop you, like, well, what will this do to the people around me, right? They go over that bump. And it's no longer, you know, that is no longer a consideration. And that is a pretty black place. And it starts with, you know, nobody can understand me and I'm not going to talk about it. And, you know, or there's certain aspects of it I don't talk about. And so it's just hard. And then I think the hardest thing is that there's no do-over, man. There's no, hey, wait a minute, you know, can we try this again? Or hold on, let me just tell you that I love you. There's none of that. The finality of death to me is one of the hardest things to deal with. And that there is none of that anymore. Things that characterize every other aspect of our life don't characterize death. But those two things, and that's why not being afraid to talk about it, as simple as that is so fundamental to getting through, you know, things that are difficult. But and one more thing I wanted to say about your pilgrimage to the orphanage. You know, I mean, you can imagine her. I don't know if you called her and told her about that, or you sent her pictures, or some combination of both. I mean, you can imagine the absolute joy, right? And from the person who is working in refugee camps in the vicinity of Hong Kong years ago, that is in her soul, right? And to see that the thing that she conceived in her head, right? And to see the pictures that you sent, I'm sure pictures of joy for little kids. That had to be a wonderful day in her life.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and one thing I should have mentioned too, I mean, she worked in a school for kids who are mentally disabled, you know, so her whole life, literally, you know, I told you kind of two bookend stories, but her whole life was devoted to that. And, right. You know, again, it's, I mean, so the lessons, I mean, this is, you know, I'm telling you a personal story, but, right. You know, the universal lesson, if there is a universal lesson, I suppose, is that you just, you know, we think of suicide as being the ultimate selfish act. But the point is that it's often really unselfish people who do it. And, you know, time and time again, when we talk about trying to, you know, we say, well, I don't understand it. That's almost meaningless. Of course, we don't understand it because we're not in that moment. You know, a chaplain once described it to me as a heart attack of the soul. You know, it's just a bad description.
Yeah, you know, I don't look at it as a selfish act anymore. I mean, when does suicide become a rational act? When it makes the pain go away?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly right. To them, I imagine it's supremely, you know, it seems supremely rational.
Right. I think, and so to me, you know, especially for a woman like your sister, I mean, who's a smart woman and who's got a lot of life experience, if she's into her sixth decade like I am, and you know, how does this make sense? Well, I think it can only make sense for anybody when you make the pain go away, right? When this is going to make, you know, the pain and what I feel and this black place that I'm in, I don't see a path through it, and it will make this go away, and I won't be a burden to anybody. And so, you know, and again, so I don't see, I've gone from, you know, where I thought it was, you know, like, you know, a lot of people do the ultimate selfish act, you know, but here you're describing a person who's lived an extremely unselfish life. All of a sudden at the end of it, she's going to become a selfish person. Well, no, that's not her. So
yeah,
how do we make this make sense for the rest of us who are here in her wake, that somebody so selfless, you know, could, and so I don't think the act can be, her act can be described like that. I mean, it just is, you know what I mean?
I agree with you, Mac. I think you're absolutely correct. And, you know, there's another part of all these experiences that seem to come together. And these are things that are, you know, my sister was very isolated because of she had lots of friends, but the, you know, the whole COVID isolation kind of accentuated, you know, the mental sense of isolation. And then, you know, I can think of two close friends, actually, both of whom were retired 06s, who took their lives, and preceding that was a period of self-isolation, you know, cutting themselves off from ties, or just not making the effort, right? Because you do need to make an effort, especially after you get out. When we're in the military and we're in uniform, those social bonds
come
in the course of every day, right?
Right. No, your tribe, staying connected to your tribe is so huge. I mean, it's how we live our life. And now all of a sudden I'm on my own and it's not going well.
And I'm
not connected to the people that have always buoyed me, have always been there for me. I'm in this different weird place, and that's why, I mean, again, I mean, the full sixth commandment of post-traumatic winning is you've got to talk about your shit and you've got to stay connected to your tribe.
You've got to, yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Let me drop one other thing in here. And the other thing I talk about is going to see a therapist.
Yeah.
Right, our relationships with therapists, there's nobody I know that has an enduring relationship with a therapist. That's why you have to do that on a dual track by talking. Whatever you talk to the therapist about, you should talk to somebody else who loves you, who will not judge you. Hopefully it's a spouse. For me, it's my cousin Tom because I don't have a spouse. And so you dual track that. So then when you say, I either financially or by time or by commute, I'm not going to go see my therapist anymore, I still have that outlet, right?
That is a really good point, Mac, that because time and again you meet people, and myself included, who have gone to see a therapist and then are perhaps not getting what they expect out of it, or circumstances change and you move on, and you absolutely do need that backup, and that backup, it can't be a therapist alone, and it can't be a friend/family member alone. It's got to be that dual track, because, you know, and you've heard more of these stories than I have, but time and again I've heard guys tell me, you know, hey, listen, I tried going to see a therapist, but you know what? I knew more, you know, I could have always guessed what he was going to say next. And, you know, I mean, there are good and bad therapists there. And it's not just good and bad. It's the fact that that is a particular type of relationship that you don't always hit right the first time. So it's okay to shop around. And in the meantime, though, you absolutely need someone else to fall back on. And you know, to the point about isolation, it's that, you know, it's kind of that encroaching perfect storm thing that you get out, and then as you start feeling more isolated, it becomes mentally and physically more of an effort to reach out to other people. And the more you don't reach out, the more you kind of sink into that feeling of isolation, you know. And
the harder it is. The harder it is. And I talk to guys all the time. Like, do you stay connected to your guys? Like, no, not anymore. I said, okay, look, today, create a text window, you know, with your guys. How many were there? Well, there's four of us. Okay. And just say, what's up, motherfuckers, and watch what happens. And you don't have to talk about your problems. You know, just stay connected, because you'll know simply by the fact that he's not participating anymore. And you pick up the phone, and I do it all the time with my guys. Hey, what's going on with you? Sorry, Dad. I've just been working my ass off. I haven't had time. Okay, do not go River City on us. Got it? Like, I'm sorry. All right, I'll come up on the net now. But you know what that is? What are you saying? I love you, man. I care about you. Are you okay? And everybody needs that, and especially us, because we gravitated to that environment. We thrived in that environment, and then all of a sudden we just walk away from it. Don't walk away from it. Those ties are too strong, and those relationships are too important in your life. And it's the warmest, best place in the world to talk shit, to bust balls, to do the shit we normally do. And I mean, it's hugely, hugely important, you know, to do that. And you can imagine the loneliness that people go through when all of a sudden that's not a part of your life anymore.
That's right. And although it seems, you know, it seems like an obstacle to pick up the phone and call someone, it seems like, you know, becomes an increasingly difficult step to take. But the thing is that once you start talking, and you've been in this situation, Mac, once you start talking to someone that you knew, say in the Marine Corps or in the military, it just becomes very easy.
Oh, it's natural, right? I mean,
hey, what's going on? What are you, hey, you know, and pretty quickly, whether you're just sharing memories or you find that the conversation is effortless, and you hang up feeling better.
Oh, my God.
Your buddy's full of, even if your buddy's like a dismal Jonah, you know, like Rob Schwartz, you may be listening. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. Just bullshitting.
No, speaking of losers, right? Like Rob Schwartz, right? I mean, but you, and he's actually, you don't know this, but I that's who I was talking about when I said, because he has a horseshoeing business, right? And so there's like three other guys in it, and we text, and you know, and it's mostly nonsense. Sometimes it gets serious, but mostly nonsense. And he's shoeing horses, and he doesn't come up on the net. So I pick up the phone. Hey, what is going on with you? And he's like, I know. And he's like, all right, Dad. I'm like, yeah, do not go River City. So oddly enough, your nemesis, Schwartz, is who I was talking about.
That is, that's great. I know he's not my nemesis. Rob's an awesome human being, but you know, he's all like right. All of us. I mean, you go through, and you know, I didn't mean to single in on Rob, but
no, we can. Let's talk about his problem.
Rob, like all of us, goes through, you know, life changes, difficult life changes. I mean, remote part of the country on a, you know, on a ranch and so, you know, credit to you to do that. That is so important.
No, but my point is that it is so easy to do, right? It is so easy to do, because all you have to do is just say, what is up? And then everybody you start laughing, and then you catch up and you talk. And as you said, it's effortless. Effortless. And we need each other. We need each other, and we need that form of, dare I say, spiritual sustainment, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And
you don't realize how much you need it until you're introduced back into it.
Well, you know, do you know Trent Gibson?
You know, Gib- uh, no, you know, I don't.
Gib- he was an IOC guy, and I met him in Iraq in 2004. He was out on the border with 3-7, and yeah. He was Jason Dunham's company commander.
No kidding.
Yeah, and then he was with us in Afghanistan in 2010-11. Gibby lives up in Maine. He came out. Do you know Chris Bronzy?
Yeah, sure did.
So Chris just took over, I think, the 15th MU. And yeah. So at his change of command, Gibby flew all the way out from Maine. And we, after the change of command and the social, we went to, down in Oceanside, that Crab Shack place in Oceanside Harbor that's been there for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're in there. There's about, 6 or 7 of us that deployed together to Afghanistan. And he was sitting next to me. And, you're just having the best time talking shit, right? General Furness is there. Some other guys are there. And we're just laughing and talking shit. And he's sitting next to me and looked at me and goes, I forgot how much I love this.
Yeah.
And so, we all go through that. We all go through periods of kind of moving in and out of it. But it's an essential part of our mental health. An essential part of our mental health is the team aspect of our mental health. And how important our teams have been to us, especially as Marines. And, you got to reconnect with those guys, man. Take the first step because let me tell you, they're dying to do it too. And as yeah. I said, there's no warmer place on the planet than that. And so
that's it's what in the end keeps us in, right? So long, but
those times.
But you're right. It is so. It is easy to lose track of the how important that is. And the other piece is that the ones who are having real problems lose track quickest, and so it takes a concerted effort on everyone's behalf, just as you did, to reach out to Rob. So these things.
I didn't really reach out to him. I counseled him. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, same thing.
Right. A subordinate.
You still wave around that fake aura of authority.
It's not fake. It's substantial.
A natural sycophant like Bob. but how to get people to respond. That's good. These things that we're talking about are not trite.
No. Let me interject something. Here's the problem. You don't know, right? All we know is the tip of the iceberg that we see. And we all know that most of the iceberg, even with the people that we know pretty well, there's a lot of it that we don't see. And no. So the hope is if you can stay connected, right, that they will feel comfortable enough to send you a text that says, do you have a minute to talk to me?
Yeah.
That's what you hope. That's why you invest the time and you stay close so that they will feel comfortable.
You make it easy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. But again, that's hard. That's hard. I mean, you look at what, your family has just gone through. And as you said, the guilt and you look at that. And here's somebody who you think you would hope would feel that, right? That they were struggling. Could I, do you have a minute to talk to me? Of course I do, man. And so even when you do that, it doesn't always work out, But you have to do that.
It doesn't. Here's the other thing too, that, I realized too, being on the other side of the coin and having to, break the news about bad things that have happened, death of loved ones, or console people afterwards. And there's always part of you that feels helpless and that you can never step inside that circle of grief. Well, you can't really get inside that circle of grief, but the important thing is this, is just saying anything is helpful. And even though it's difficult, a mutual friend of ours, Brian Fitzgibbons, but known to everyone as Fitz, generations of Marines, IOC instructor now up in DC. I've known Fitz since you and he harassed me and tried to make me a supply officer some 30 years ago.
Which we failed miserably.
Yeah, but he was, he was the first As kind of the news got out, and I did put out to friends that I'd lost my sister, because otherwise it's just incrementally breaking the news right over and over again. Fitz called me, right away, and I could tell, it's a difficult call, but there's, we're such old friends, and it didn't matter what he said. It was the fact, I told him the fact that he called meant the world to me. I just say that because often people will say, oh, I just didn't know what to say. Even if you just say, hey man, I'm thinking about you. I can't imagine what you're going through, but I'm thinking about you. Or if you're religious, I'm praying for you, or whatever it may be. That just makes a big difference. Everyone understands you cannot step inside that circle of grief, but by showing empathy, sympathy, that that means a lot. And I know we're talking about squishy things here, but
no, we're not, because now as a consumer of it. When you go through this stuff, I mean, that song, You Are the Wind Beneath My Wings, there's a lot of days when the thing that keeps you upright is the energy and the love of other people. Because those days are devastating. The loss of your daughter, that is not the circle of life, man. And that is crushing, soul crushing. And, I remember – when we buried my nephews, 6 and 4 years old, they were murdered, and they, and I remember, people don't know what to say. And I always tell people, if you don't know what to say, just go up and hug them.
That's right.
But squeeze them. I had a Gold Star mother tell me at a reunion, and I had watched her, and I'll describe this for you real quick. I think it was Kilo Company. It was Kilo or Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, in Waco, Texas, in 2019, last summer. It was the first time they were together since they fought together in Fallujah in 2004. And there's a woman, and she's an Asian woman from Florida, and I'm looking at her son's picture because I kept it. Her son's name is, he was Corporal Andrew Bowling, and he was killed on April 19th. I'm sorry. He was killed on November 11th, 2004. And so in Fallujah. And so I was watching her, and they had portraits of everybody in their company that had been killed in their deployment to Iraq. And so the ceremonies and the different things that were going on had kind of subsided a little bit, and everybody was kind of on the periphery talking. And she was over by a table that had portraits of everybody that had been killed. And that there was flowers on the table, and she was meticulously wiping the pictures and dusting them and arranging the flowers. And I remember watching that, saying, "She's still being his mom, right?
Yeah,
she's still taking care of him."
It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Right. So I made a point to walk over and introduce myself. And when I introduced myself to her, I gave her a hug. And she looked at me and she said, "I love the way Marines hug me." And I said, "How do Marines hug you?" She said, "You can feel their love because the way they hug me strong." And so I tell people, and this is no shit advice, don't say things, right, that you've heard other people say. Like, there's a meaning in this. God needed them more than you do, right? The hardest steel goes through the hottest fire, because I just – standing behind my sister, that's so hurtful, because if you could be in this position and hear that, really, God needed more than I do? There's a purpose in this? So yeah. my advice to people is always, do not say boilerplate stuff. Say what Andy said, "I love you. I'm here for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if I find out you're struggling and you don't call me, I'm going to be fucking pissed, and I'm going to come to your house, and I'm going to raise some shit. Do you understand me?" Right, which always makes them laugh.
Yeah.
Right, because it's not really what you're supposed to say. Yeah. But that love and that hug, you don't forget that stuff, right? And it does buoy you, and it is hugely important. It is hugely important because listening to you and I talking about this shit, right, that it's made a dent in us, you know, and I mean, these things happen, you know, for me years ago, but I'll never forget that stuff. And I'll never forget that, you know, Corporal Bowling's wife, his mother, and her words, you know, about what that hug feels like and how much that love is, how important that love is to her and how important it was for her to be there 15 years later and to be with them 15 years later. And
yeah,
so,
right,
so this shit doesn't go away.
No, I've heard that time and again from Gold Star parents, wives, the comfort that they derive from kind of being exposed to the camaraderie that embraced their loved one. That's, you know, that's a great point. And here's another point, Mac, too, that for any of your listeners who are dealing with grief or, you know, and we all have to deal with grief at some time. So hopefully this will be useful and helpful to someone, is that there is no template for grief. You know, someone, when I lost Kayla, one of her college professors wrote to me in a really nice letter. And basically, you know, he said in his son, still remember his son's name, Ben, had killed himself when he was 18. And he said, look, there are you've got a hard road ahead. Basically, he said, I understand that. And you will get, and there will be people who tell you, you know, how to grieve or have opinions on how you grieve. And grief is such a weird thing that it goes back and forth, so that within a day or two of losing someone, you may find yourself laughing at a joke or smiling at something. And that's okay. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean you're heartless. And what he meant was that some people might judge that and think, oh, he's doing okay. Look at that. He's laughing. But then 10 hours later, you may be, you know, or an hour later, you may find yourself just in, you know, the pits of despair. And then back to laughing at something. You know, it's, there's no rhyme or reason. You know, the honest truth is that life does go on. Life has to go on. And with that comes a capacity too for humor and, being able to enjoy things again. However, you know, everyone feels guilty about doing that. I still, you know, sometimes feel guilty about being happy or enjoying something, you know, and I think Kayla's no longer around. I think, you know, what right have I to do that? But it has to go on that way. So it's okay. You know, it's okay to have lighter moments and along, because there's got to be something to alleviate, you know, the down times that we all know. Like, you know, is coming.
Now, just for the record, Kayla's your daughter, right?
Yeah.
And Kayla's your daughter. The well, and that's, to me, Andy, the significance of post-traumatic winning is that, you know, and I'll quote Viktor Frankl, you know, when you can give your suffering meaning and you can use it to change the lives of other people, to show them a path, to turn on the light in a really black place for them, right? That's as good as you can do as a human being, right? And so those are moments of joy when you can change somebody else's life and show them that. And I think that's the only path that's left for us. You know, I mean, the whole coexistence thing and endurance, I mean, that sucks. That sucks. And so to me, if you don't gravitate and if we don't teach people about transformation, I mean, the other interstates you can go down, if you don't go down what I call interstate 4, which is, you know, the transformation interstate, if you go down the I'm going to fake it or I'm going to fake it and drink, if you go down those two, you know, I mean, it just doesn't work out very well. I mean, you're going to live a diminished life. And so I honestly, that's why I honestly believe, I mean, what I've learned that other veterans have taught me, we as veterans can be such an asset to our communities, you know, if you understand the truth and then you just touch people that you come in contact with, that are dealing with all the stuff that life offers. I mean, you know, I met somebody, you know, recently who lost their mother in a nursing facility, and they got a call that, you know, hey, your mom's, you know, sick, showing signs of respiratory illness, and then the following morning they got a call that said your mother's dead, and they're like, they're devastated because they couldn't get into the place, right? So
yeah.
So our mother contracted this thing, lived with it. Nobody noticed, and we got a call 24 hours before she died, and a call telling us she died, and they're devastated by that.
Yeah, missing that opportunity say goodbye or to intervene
to help in some way, to be there, all of that. Yeah. And so,
and that helplessness adds to, it accentuates the
right.
Everything. Yeah.
But when you can begin to show them a path, right, that you can take this and it doesn't have to be a dead end or this black alley, that you can take, and in that person's memory, you can change the lives of other people. That's as good as it gets, and that's why, to me, the more I do the post-traumatic winning thing, the more I know it's 1,000,000% right. It is simply, right, our collective knowledge as an institution, right, handed down by, again, all these different people that tell you the same thing.
And well, there's no, so what you're hitting on, there's no other program that really does that. We've seen the military come a long way in the last 20 years, but nevertheless, there's no program that does exactly what you do, which is, kind of a compilation of experiences, things that we've been talking about, to include your dual track counseling piece. Right. Everyone says go and get help, but to go deeper than that and say, hey, it's okay if you get help and you're not happy with the therapist that you have, it's okay, A, to change it. But B, you always must have that backup. And that's just an example. Right. And here's something else too that, again, hopefully this doesn't sound trite, but, life has hard edges, sharp edges. And accepting that, even embracing that at times is an important aspect. And the alternative, which is what you hit on, is to always try and dull those sharp edges, whether it's through alcohol or drugs or just trying to ignore them. And that does not work. At some point, if you want to come out of that hole, and even if you're not feeling in a hole, you've got to accept those sharp edges. I knew by the time I came to losing Kayla, I knew that alcohol would offer no solace, but I only knew that because I had experienced sharp edges after my, particularly after my second deployment to Iraq. And I'm not pretending for a moment that I had PTSD, but I had an element of combat stress that was certainly weighing on me. And I drank too much. I wasn't a violent drunk or even a noticeable drunk, but in the evenings I would drink until I felt numb because that's the way I could sleep. And I did that for a period of months, until a couple of things happened. Oddly enough, I lost my father and then my son was born prematurely. And I realized I had to, I had to come out of it. So ironically, semi traumatic events shook me out of it. And thereafter I realized, that's not the way to go. And thank goodness I knew that when I was confronted with tragedy again, that to expect the sharp edges and not try and blunt them, just to work through them.
Well, Andy, a lot of guys don't, they don't figure that out. Right. And we know people that, take a different road. I mean, they double down on it. There's more grief, so there's more alcohol involved. There's more drugs involved, and so you were, God bless you, and you were fortunate in terms of you figured it out. I mean, a lot of people don't, and they begin to live a dual life, which is, I'm this way externally, but then when I'm by myself, I escape into this world of, and here's my criticism of the way we get treated. Historically, what we've done is we've numbed the system, we've numbed the symptoms with drugs, and then we get sent to talk about it. you know, I don't know the number of words haven't been invented, right, to ease the pain of you lose your daughter, your son's born prematurely, and you lose your father. Where are the words? Is there some point when I say a million words that do I feel relief? But that's the approach, is this approach of endurance. And it's a head scratcher for me, because there's a better way, right? Instead of being a disabled veteran, how about if we create you're an enabled veteran, right? In that, so when we send you home, you have this set of tools, and you can, when you hear somebody hurting, all you got to do is look at them and say, hey, man, can I talk to you for a second? And then, you know, you go down that road. You know there's nothing wrong with you, right? That what you're going through is absolutely normal for what you've been through. And then they'll ask you if you're a therapist, and you say, no, I used to be a Marine. And they'll say, well, what do you guys know about it? Like, we know everything about it, okay? Just pay attention. But that's all it takes to start the conversation, and it's rooted in the truth. And I mean, and I love it, and I cannot do it often enough. And then what happens when you go home is that you can't change any of those things, you know, but what you just did is you changed somebody's life. So there's that moment of joy, and over time, those moments of joy overwhelm that trauma. And I know that because I live it.
It's through trying to help other people. Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Mac, because there is, you know, there's another one way that people try to dull those sharpened edges in addition to alcohol is, you know, trying to think back to how it was before whatever event occurred or series of bad events, you know, whether it was back to where a time when death or tragedy was not part of your life. And, you know, there's a tendency to be wistful and nostalgic about that part of your life before dark clouds appeared. But the point is that this, and you just hit on it, that you may not realize it, but you are you have the ability to be a better and stronger person because of that tragedy. And the only way you can derive any sense or meaning, I don't believe there is meaning in honestly tragedy, but the only thing that you can glean from it is to be a better person and turn it around and try and help other people, even if it is simply by recounting your experience and telling them, hey, listen, I'm still here and life goes on, and I understand what you're feeling, and you're feeling right now as though life can never go on, and it may not be exactly the same, but you will be better. You will be, you know, if you will be a stronger, better person because of these awful things that you've had to go through. Does that make sense?
No, I mean, I live it. It absolutely makes sense. But you know what? It's not the popular narrative, right? Because my first experiences talking to Marines about this stuff, I learned that, you know, they think and I'll tell you what, and I can recount it. It was in 2006, and I had talked to Marines, you know, and I used to tell them, hey, you're never going to get over this stuff, and that's okay. And so we had an incident where there was a guy, you know, in the proverbial white opal in Iraq. He had a mortar system rigged in the trunk, you know, and so he would stop, right? He would open the trunk, he'd drop, you know, six rounds, and then he'd, you know, shut the trunk and he'd drive away.
It was always an opal, wasn't it?
Oh, my God. I mean, the opal was everywhere. And so I can't remember which unit it was, but they were out in an eight-vehicle patrol. The mortar rounds went, right, and they gave the location of the point of origin. They split into 2 4-vehicle sets to converge on it from different angles. Well, in the process of converging, they see the white opal, and it's him. And so they're chasing him, but they're converging from 2 different directions. It winds up being a blue-on-blue as he gets out of the vehicle and runs. The patrol leader sends 2 Marines back and say, grab the vehicle and bring it here. 1 Marine throws his rifle in the passenger side window and hops in to drive the vehicle. The other one is near the building kind of in overwatch, looking around to make sure nobody shoots at him. And at that point, the other patrol comes around the corner. And they see the white opal, they see the weapon sticking out of the window, and they engage it. Well, mercifully, nobody's killed there. By the time they get it stopped, though, they look down the street, and there's a bike in the street, and there's something behind the bike, and they go running down there. And it's a 13-year-old kid, and he had stopped to watch. And he got hit in the head with a round, a stray round. And now somebody sticks their thumb in his head, and they're screaming for the doc, and the doc comes running down, and, you know, the doc hops down, and he just looks at everybody, you know, and they're yelling at him, you know, you got to save him, doc. He's a little kid, right? And the doc just looks up, and he's like, he's dead, right? Devastating, right?
Yeah.
Devastating. So this is maybe 3 weeks later, and I'd heard this kid was struggling. And so I see him, and I looked at him, and I said, hey, you got a minute? And he said, yes, sir. And I said, I heard you're struggling. I hear you can't sleep. And he looked at me and he said, how did you hear that, sir? I said, I pay attention. Is it true? And he looked at me, you know, and kind of very sheepishly, he nodded his head. And I said, you think you're fucked up, don't you? And he looked at me and goes, sir, I don't know. And, but there was that, when he said, I don't know, there was that look that I think I'm fucked up. And then I looked at him and said, well, you are fucked up. And he starts laughing. And I said, but you're fucked up like the rest of us. You're fucked up like every man or woman who's ever gone to fight for their country, right? And this has gone on since Cain fought Abel. And we can help you learn to live with it, and you can be okay. And he just looked at me, and he had this look of relief, Andy, that I'll never forget. And I said, you ever watch a History Channel? And I said, yes. And he said, yes. And he said, I said, those guys from World War II, they're still crying about that shit. I said, and when you watch them describe it on those documentaries, they can describe it in slow motion, high definition, and that shit was over 70 years ago. I said, so, you know, that thing happened 2.5 weeks ago? And he said, yes, sir. And I said, there's nothing wrong with you, okay? And it's going to make you cry at times. And I said, so when your allergies act up, which is what you have to learn to say, are you crying? No, my allergies are acting up. Wipe your eyes. We need you to help us here and do your job. And I'll talk to you anytime you want to, and we can help you learn to cope with this. But just know this, you'll never get over this, and there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah.
And Andy, when he got up, he looked at me, and he shook my hand. And he said, thank you, sir. He said, I really need to talk to somebody like that. I said, hey, anytime you need. And he did. He came back 2 or 3 different times to just shoot the shit. And I'd ask him, how's it going? He said, well, I haven't been sleeping well. I said, hey, nothing wrong with you, man. All right? Don't forget that. There's nothing wrong with you. This stuff's hard. And so that's, to me, the when you can provide relief and let that person know, because they do believe that they're fucked up.
Yeah.
Right?
Two things you did. So you let them know, hey, this is normal. And the second part is, but we need you.
Right.
You know, we absolutely understand how you're feeling, but you're important to us. You need, you know, even if it's a very functional aspect of, hey, we need, you know, we need you as the, whatever it is, the soul gunner or whatever. You're right. An integral part of this right. team. We rely on you.
Right.
You know, that is a huge part of resilience and recovery. And I think why people struggle when they get out of the military, because they no longer feel that sense of being required, of being needed. So, hey, Mac, you've done a masterful job in talking.
I did not mean to. I looked.
Yeah, I'll tell you where I'm heading now. You'll probably find this amusing. There's a, in St. Petersburg, which is about an hour and a half away, is a guy named Ed Dropic, who was one of my squad leaders when I was a lieutenant. And he contacted me the other day because his nephew wants to join the Marine Corps. And he said, I can't think, you know, I'm paraphrasing him, I can't think exactly of what to tell him, but I know the guy who will. So, you know, good and bad. And of course, I'm biased. So, you know, the kid will probably end up joining the Marine Corps.
No, I don't know that. Once they get it in their head, I had that conversation with both my sons, right? Because I figured that it was my moral responsibility as their dad to tell them the truth, If I ever had to stand at their graveside, I had to know that. And so I said, so here's what I said: look, first of all, it's got to be what you want, all right? Not because of my friends, the Chris Bronzies you've met, and all these great guys that are funny and have these great stories, but you're going to get a set of dress blues that'll get you laid at any wedding you ever go to. And if you go to a wedding and you're wearing that uniform, and you
that's a myth, by the way.
and you don't get laid, you'll be the first Marine that's ever happened to in the history of the Marine Corps. Second, when something bad happens in the world, you can get sent there, and you can die in a pool of your own blood. And when you're dying, if what you think is, I've hated this job for the last 5 years, I can't believe I'm dying, that's not what you should be thinking. What you should be thinking is, I can't believe this happened to me. I never thought it would. I'm not going to see my family. I'm not going to get to be a Marine anymore. This sucks. That's what you should be thinking. So join for the right reasons, because the stakes are too high. It's got to be what you want. It's got to be your passion. And if it is, it's a great organization. If it's not your passion, there's a whole lot of other ways to serve, and just find a different way, a different channel for it. So that was my pitch, but I don't think it worked because they both joined.
I mean, I'm always honest. I talk about I talk about all the downside and the fact that sometimes it is just plain tedious, but I do tell whoever it is, I do tell them this, that, And wherever I go in the States, and actually just most recently when I came back to the UK just last week, there's a guy, he's one of the immigration guys, checking my passport, and he says, simplify. He said, I was in the Marine Corps. How many times have you heard this? He said, I was in the Marine Corps, and asked him, how long were you in? He said, 4 years. He said, every single day I just look forward to my EAS. I wanted to get out, but every single day since, I missed it. He goes, I didn't realize what I had, and that I've heard that time and again from guys I've run into in airports or, in cities around the United States. They never again had that level of, the things that we've been talking about, the camaraderie or just the reality of the experiences, even the shitty experiences, especially the shitty experiences. Nothing they do again will, for many of them, will have that same sense of reality. And
no, you're never on. You're never tell, on tell, a better
the sharp
team.
Edges. The sharp edges. They thought they hated them, but because they had people around them to share those sharp edges of life and their experiences, they miss it. Right. They're off. Right. Hey man, now you've got me. You know what? I should have remembered from IOC what a
artful
snake oil salesman you are. You've got me right on exactly. We're just hitting 1 hour right now.
Well, that's not my fault. I was more than ready. I'm waiting for you as a grown up.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I'm not a grown up.
You're a retired colonel in the Marine Corps. That means you were a senator in the Marine Corps, right? So I would think that most senators can manage at least their own times, but obviously you can't, Andy. So I will go ahead and let you go. First of all, again, I appreciate, as always, you coming on. This was not the discussion I thought we would have. I was just wanted to talk to you about current events, and we'll do that another time. But again, Andy, our thoughts and prayers with you and your family and your sister and your sisters. And I know that you'll make a difference and use this to somehow or other as a tool to change other people's lives, and in that way honor Susan's memory as you've done throughout much of your life. So all the best of luck to you in that. I know you'll do it. And thanks for doing this today.
Hey, thanks very much, Mac, and thank you to all of your listeners too.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.